This is a session entitled Creationism. Actually, it'll be dealing with both the questions and theories raised by the creationist school, and then also those with whom they are in disagreement, namely those who teach one form or another of the evolutionary interpretation. And I raise this because it is a part of the contemporary American religious scene, and that is the general topic which I've been dealing with this week, and we'll be dealing with tomorrow and also on Saturday for those who are here for the rest of the week. And I would like to go through the basic arguments in a little detail and then leave as much time as possible for discussion, because it does have all kinds of implications for our thinking, and probably for some places with the public schools and whatever else you would like to bring in. Now, basically, what had happened, just by way of background, was that after the famous Scopes trial in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee, the teaching of evolution in the public schools was no longer considered a legal issue. It predominated primarily the public school teaching methods and insights for a long period of time, and no longer could those who disagreed with the evolutionist theory take their case to court and win. That's the important point, because what I want to establish first of all is this is not only a theological battle and a biblical battle, but it's also a very much of a legal battle with this. And the evolutionist school in interpreting the origins and the descent of the species really was in the ascendancy for a long period of time, completely dominating, with only a few isolated pockets of resistance throughout the countries well into the 1970s. But starting with the general resurgence of conservatism and both fundamentalist and to some degree evangelical thought in the 1970s, there were those who were listening to what was happening in the public schools, especially in the biology courses in the high schools, and decided that on the basis of what they understood and what they believed, that there was nothing necessarily inevitable or fixed about the policy of allowing the evolutionary interpretation to go really unchallenged. And I rang the bell, but I guess somebody else has another program. All right. Anyway. And so we have had, and it came to a climax, as some of you well know, in Sacramento in California this last March, cases coming before the courts which argue that there must be, to some degree, more equal time for the creationist interpretation of the origins of the species and the development of species throughout the ages. The media wanted very much to build up the case that came to the courts in California into a Scopes trial. Because for some of you who might remember American history, the Scopes trial was one of the great media events of the 1920s. It's almost a household word even today at that time, because there was kind of a showdown between William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow, and one of the interesting sidelights was that Bryan, after his long and distinguished career, died just about, I think it was 3 or 4 days after the trial was over. It was just as though he could hang on long enough for the trial, and then gave up with this. But what became clear, and this is the point, what became clear in the Sacramento trial and the ruling made by the judge, which I'll review very briefly, was that this was not at all, in spite of what the media tried to make it out to be, this was not at all another Scopes trial. And I'll go specifically into the reasons for that a little bit later down the line. What it was the ruling by a judge in relationship to a case brought by creationists who have their national headquarters in San Diego, who challenged the material which was being used, which was being included, I should say, in the biology textbooks in the California high schools. Now, one thing is important here, and it is necessary to explain, because it isn't true in every state. In California, there is one central purchasing agency for the textbooks. The students use, generally speaking, the same general textbooks throughout the state. And it is not up to each individual school district or each individual teacher to pick out what school texts are used. So if nothing else, you can readily see the enormous economic stakes that were involved with this, because if you were a publisher and your biology, your high school biology textbook had just one viewpoint, and suddenly the state throws that one out, obviously you'd want to accommodate to something else with that. All right. So anyway, the case came before the courts, and before the court, it was not a jury trial. The judge made his decisions, and in the short run, just by way of the review, in the short run, generally speaking, the decision was a victory for the creationists. The judge ruled in this way, he ordered the teachers in the high school biology class to include, when they were teaching origins and descent of species and so on, the judge ruled ordering the teachers to include such qualifying phrases as "most scientists believe" or "scientists hypothesize" when they were teaching about evolution. They could no longer say, I mean, if they were pressed or if there was any investigation, they could no longer say that there was no question, but that the evolutionist interpretation was correct. Now they were required by the ruling to place some qualifying expressions. I want to be sure that's clear. Some qualifying expressions such as "scientists hypothesize" or "most scientists believe" with this. But the judge did stop short, no question. The judge did stop short of ordering the teaching of creationism. This was not a complete victory for the creationists. But he wanted these qualifying expressions, including it. Now, by way of interpretation, this is what we want to get at. The creationists recognized this as more of a victory than a loss. They would have liked, of course, a sweeping decision in favor, entirely in their favor, but they were satisfied with this really for two reasons. First of all, their position, the creationist position, was not totally repudiated, as it had been in some other states. There had been some other cases like this earlier where the court just threw out the creationist viewpoint, or the creationist case, I should say, but that wasn't the case in California, and California has the most, is the largest state in population in the country, and the idea is that if you can get the momentum going in California for creationism, then you can get it, this can carry over into other states also. So the creationist said with this, no. Secondly, they see it, this is sort of the other side of the same coin. They see it as the opening wedge, as the first step, as one legal precedent on which to build for taking their case through the courts in the other states. Oftentimes, this is the way in which major decisions are made. You don't have the first time a case gets to a court on a constitutional issue such as this, you don't have a major ruling, but the judges, or the judge in this case, will make a partial ruling, then you'll bring in another case and he'll move a little further, and another case, and eventually then you'll have a major case and a sweeping ruling is done. And thus, the limited victory here by the creationists is seen as the first step, and then when they can find another, what they would consider to be good case, to bring to the courts where they can have what they would call a strong argument, then they will carry out they will carry it to the judges again and hope for a little widening, a little broadening of the decisions itself. All right, but the creationist resurgence in our time hasn't been limited just to the California case. It got the most publicity, and I think it should, because California is a key or a swing state here. But there have been other activities of the creationists also, which have been going on at this time. For instance, the activities of the Institute for Christian Research has become very active. I have their newsletter here if any of you want to look at this. They have state and local affiliate chapters in almost all of the states. And at last count, and I haven't gotten the information any later than March on this, but as of March of this year, they had bills in front of 27 state legislatures for introducing some form of teaching of creationism in that particular state. They have decided to work to see through the state legislatures. This is the way to go, not through a federal, not the federal route, but through the state route. With this, and therefore they have enough strength in 27 states to be able to get their representatives, or people who will represent them, that's a better way of putting it, to bring these same kinds of laws before the legislatures there, and then we will just have to wait and see, because most state legislatures are in session or just in session, and And you know, the bills will come out pretty soon with this. A third point, besides the California case and the 27 state legislatures, would be, and we don't know, there's no way we have of having an exact head count here, hundreds, maybe even more, but certainly hundreds of local school boards across the country have brought in textbooks that give at least equal time, if not strong support for the creationist viewpoint. This is done in anticipation of the fact that the courts will uphold them. And that there are many localities or school districts throughout the country. It isn't limited to just one part of the country. It's in all sections of the country. School boards are going ahead. There are textbook companies who are having their books rewritten to accommodate the creationists. And this is true, and what I'm talking about obviously right here is the public schools. I'm not talking about what we call the Christian day schools. There's a very good article in the June 8th issue of Time magazine, by the way, on the Christian day schools with us. Obviously, they don't have the kinds of regulations that the public schools do. Okay, with us. Okay, first of all, with that background, let me go very briefly through the creationist position, because I think it's understood by most of us, and I do want to spend more time, and that doesn't mean I'm more in favor of one side than the other, on the evolutionist viewpoint. I have to mention that because some of my friends from Minneapolis here will remember way back in the 1950s, we had a case where a very far-right ultra-fundamentalist argued that the Encyclopedia of Social Sciences, which is a definitive multi-volume work on the knowledge in the social sciences, she argued that it was Gerda Cook from the old Christian Research Institute. She argued that it was four times more in favor of Marxism than it was in favor of democracy, because the article on Marxism was four times longer than the one on democracy. And therefore, the editor, it was Max Lerner, the editor was four times more in favor of Marxism than that. Please don't interpret my remarks or time my remarks here as being loaded in favor of one side more than the other. Some things are more complicated to explain than others. I'll go ahead with this without further explanations. Now, very few of the creationists, at least the creationist leaders, are arguing for what we call instant or fiat creation. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Fiat creation, F-I-A-T. Fiat creation means that they believe that all of the universe and the cosmos as we know it was created in 6 days or 24 hours. There are very few creationists who argue for that position. It's not a widespread or an attractive alternative among these, but they do argue basically that the universe or the cosmos, such as we know it, is something around 100,000 years old, rather than the date given by most evolutionists, which would be something like 4.5 million years old, with this. And I'm drawing here for the creationist viewpoint from Dr. A. E. Wilder Smith. If any of you are familiar with the creationist viewpoint, and Dr. A. E. Wilder Smith goes something like this, and it's very brief because the other side is much more complicated. That doesn't mean that it's better just because it's more complicated, but we want to go through with this. All right. Now, the basic argument always that the creationists use is that there had to be, you know, some sort of formal beginning. There had to be some orderly process at the very beginning of the creation of life, or somewhere along the line, life had to have started. It did not happen in a random fashion, but it happened, according to the creationist viewpoint, in some form of order with some form of what we would call today programming that existed above and beyond the kind of natural processes that most evolutionists would argue. I know and many of you, I'm sure, have had to answer to your children the question, who created God? And I'd like to see, if we had time, it'd be fun to get the answers that you gave to your children, because I punted on that one. I put the ball on the other court. Maybe some of you have good answers, but you know, who created God with us? But that would be, in a sense, the kind of beginning that the creationists would argue with us. All right. They argue that there has existed from the first time, for the first signs of creationism, an orderly, steady process in which there has been no question, but there has been an increasing complexity of life, that there has been a period of time in which the whole of creation has taken on in increasing complexity. But the important point always was that there was a supreme being, there was an active agent, that which the creationists would call God, responsible for all of this, and that there is therefore the sort of the assurance that the universe and the world and life as we know it, both animal life and the life of Homo sapiens, is not something which is simply random, and that we can trust that there was some sort of final cause that we in the Christian world and in other major world religions also would call God with us. Now, one other point's important, because one of the major arguments that the evolutionists have is the argument from radioactive carbon. And using this, they argue that they can prove that the world is much more than 100,000 years old. Now, the creationists say that scientists can't use that particular thing, that radioactive carbon decay techniques don't really work, because cosmic rays could have altered the decay rate, you see, in the carbon, and that therefore they aren't fully trustworthy with us. Now, there's so much more, you know, when time marches on and we've got Vespers at 8 o'clock. So I want to spend most of the time on the other side, and I think that the other side might get some controversy going here with us. All right. Now, I'm drawing here from there's you know, many different places you could go. I'm drawing from an article by the curator of the Department of Invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural Science in New York. He's a scientist by the name of Niles Eldridge, and he argues two points. He argues with creationism and evolution. He argues, first of all, the creationists are right in saying that the evolutionists don't have all the answers. That this is a proper scientific conclusion to draw, that the evolutionists do not have all the answers. A second point he argues, and this is where he disagrees, is that the creationists, he argues, now as an evolutionist, he argues that creationists are wrong in requiring, in a sense, what we would call equal time. Because one of the things that the creationists have argued in the schools is that since evolutionism is not something on which all the scientists involved can agree on, therefore there must be some flaws in it, therefore there must be some time given to alternative kinds of explanations. The creationists, in other words, want what we would call equal time. Is that clear? I want to be sure. You know, as John would say, can you feel that? Okay, I can go on to the next page. With this. So two quick or preliminary conclusions here. First of all, yes, evolutionists would agree with creationists that the evolutionists don't have all the answers, that it's not something on which everybody can agree without any question. But secondly, they argue that the argument for equal time simply doesn't really make much sense, because they argue that the evolutionists here argue that what the creationists are proposing, and here's where we get into the controversy, and I want to be sure this is clear, what the evolutionists are arguing that the creationists are saying is that the way in which we understand the cosmos and the life in the cosmos is authoritarian, that it's fixed, it's closed, it's final. There are no loose ends. You see, this is where the evolutionists would disagree with the creationists on this point. They are, and here is where, as I said at the beginning, we talk about it. Here is where the whole thing differs from the Scopes trial, which made everything, you know, either or. What the creationists are arguing for is something close to equal time. What the and I want to be sure this is clear, because this is, then we'll go into the concrete arguments. What the creationists are arguing for is something like equal time. What the evolutionists rebut with is the fact that there can't be equal time, because the creationists aren't really teaching a pure or true form of scientific inquiry. They argue that the scientific methodology of the creationists is simply in error. And that ought to bring out some response, I think, as we go along here. But, you know, the fools rush in here where we go with this. All right. Now, why then to the evolutionists is creationism, you know, inadequate science? Why is it inadequate science? Let's look at that. And this is what Eldredge says. He said that scientific research is that enterprise of comparing ideas about what the cosmos is, how it has come to be, and what it is going to be in the future. He said, and that in science, even though scientists frequently disagree, that some ideas are better than others, that some scientific ideas are actually better, that you just can't, you know, tell students, well, here's this idea, here's that idea, and here's a third idea, and then, you know, what you do is take your choice with this and sort of have a, you know, a potluck kind of interpretation. Eldredge argues that's simply not the way good science operates with this. The criterion for selecting what is better in scientific knowledge than other ideas in scientific knowledge is the relative power of different ideas to fit our powers of observation. That's the key point. I want to repeat that. The relative power of different ideas to fit our observation. In other words, what Eldredge is arguing science is doing is simply observing and testing and going over and over and refining this back and forth again, not starting from any kind of premise, not starting from any sort of original base, but simply saying that this is the way we understand it, the way the facts are coming to us. What was it old Sergeant Friday used to say on Dragnet? You know, all I want are the facts. That shows you how old I am. And some people here probably don't even know old Sergeant Friday and dum-da-dum-dum, you remember, on Friday nights. With us, just the facts, with us, all right. Now, the goal, in other words, of science, the goal of science is greater understanding of our universe. That's the goal for everybody, but the goal for is that. Now, the method, and here's where the method of evolutionists, you see, disagree with those of creationists, the method consists of constantly challenging older ideas, modifying them, and when necessary, replacing them with newer ideas. The classic example and one that rocked the church to its very foundations would be what happened when Copernicus in 1543 proved that the sun was the center, not the earth, was the center of the universe. Because you can find various passages which taught that the sun, that the earth was the center, and when it became clear that indeed it was the sun that is the center of the universe, meant that people would have to readjust older ideas, modifying them and replace older ideas with better ones as they come along. In other words, according to the evolutionist, you see, science is not authoritarian. It's not closed, final, or finished. Its methods are flexible, they are frail, they're vulnerable, and they're open to refinement all the time with this. So, therefore, they argue the basic difference, you see, is that they don't start from the position where the answers are known and you go out and look for facts to prove the answers, but they start with the premise that we don't really know at the beginning where we are, and we'll let the facts accumulate, and then we'll test and refine as we go ahead with this. All this really comes to a head over the question then, well, are the evolutionists really teaching evolution, or are they teaching something else? Eldredge would say this, yes, that given the differences among the evolutionists, yes, indeed, they are teaching Darwinism. They are teaching a very clear form of Darwinism, and they argue that Darwin, more than any other scientist, up until 1859, when his famous book, The Origin of Species, came out, Darwin, more than any other, found a key which explains the enormous variety and differentiation, you see, among the species, and that given the variations that exist and the differences among evolutionists that exist, still yet there is something, the evolutionists argue, reliable and dependable on the Darwinian insight altogether. In the species, as they progress over the generations, all the descendants of the earlier species, now this is the evolutionist viewpoint, all descendants share some features inherited from some earlier ancestor. And as each variation, or if you like, mutation appears, the mutation is shared with the later descendants. In other words, when a change takes place, according to the evolutionists, in this vast thing we call the universe and the cosmos and all the life, in that when a change takes place, it takes place permanently, it changes, and mutation can never go back again. We'll never evolve, sort of go back again into a more, you know, simple or primitive kind of state altogether. Now, They would give, for instance, a few examples to prove their case. All forms of life have the nucleic acid RNA, as one example. Or one branch of life, the vertebrates, all share backbones with this. You all know, you know, invertebrae, and so on, as a case of one form of life sharing one common characteristic over, you know, a long period of time. Or one more example, there are, you know, so many here, but all mammals, for instance, they found, have three inner ear bones. All mammals have hair, and all mammals obviously have mammary glands, as evidence of the continuing consistency that you find as various species evolve over the centuries. Now, to go back then, the creationists would explain this pattern, you see, as the pattern which the Creator used when life was started, and the whole process of response to the natural world by Homo sapiens developed itself. This would be the explanation. But the evolutionists disagree here with the creationists on this point. They would say that what the creationists are doing is choosing any pattern. Any pattern of evolution, any pattern of mutation that go along, and say that is what God made. In other words, they are saying the creationists go out into the world and say that's the way it is because God made it and it couldn't be any other way. The evolutionists would say that there is still the opportunity for random chance, that there is no master hand, there is no sort of ultimate cosmic logic at work, but that as life develops and expands and becomes more complicated, it simply goes along without necessarily headed towards any kind of improvement or change, I mean, or any kind of improvement. That yes, there is always change according to the evolutionists, but change doesn't necessarily mean progress. We aren't necessarily any better fit to live, according to the evolutionists, in this environment than ancestors of Neanderthal man, for instance, who were fit to live in their environment at that particular time. It's just that our particular species has made certain adjustments, you know, as some evolution would say, come out of the tree, shed our tails, and stood up on our hind legs, as ways of coping which weren't used at a long time before this. All right. And what they disagree with, and I'll finish right here in just about 2 minutes, what they disagree with then is the creationist idea that the answers, you know, all the answers are already known. And that what is left then, according to the evolutionist interpretation of creationism, is simply going, in a sense, filling in the blanks. And the evolutionists argue that what is necessary, you see, especially to get this specifically into the high school classes, is to present the natural world as it was and as it is and as it might be from the standpoint of being open to change, open to refinement, open to new insights. Unless this is done, the evolutionists argue something very important in terms of understanding what free inquiry is about, all about, you know, will take place. The creationists, on the other hand, argue that the evolutionists have had their time, they've had the opportunity to prove their case, they haven't proved it, they argue among themselves, and that since the argument persists among themselves, and we've got a whole new thing if we wanted to talk about it, this biologist at Harvard, Edward Wilson, with social biology, if we want to talk about that, we could too. They've argued, the creationists argue, that they've had their day, and now that science has had its day, it's time, they argue, to get back to basics again. And so we have the argument and before us, and it's very lively in many school districts, it's lively in homes, in colleges, and I would welcome, and we've got enough time for comments, disagreements, questions, whatever. Just like a telephone switchboard lighting up right away, right?
Well, I think it's amazing to me how quick Darwin's theory came back. It was just really eagerly awaited, it seems like, by the scientific community, and it was just accepted just immediately. It, like a lot of other areas, scientific inquiry, it wasn't challenged much, and I think this is very interesting.
Well, one reason it wasn't challenged was that, I teach this as part of my course in American Intellectualism, was that the people who disagreed with it didn't have good scientific evidence to challenge it with for a long period of time. And it seemed to answer so many questions that had remained unanswered for such a long time that it became very popular because there were those who couldn't buy the creationist viewpoint and were looking for something else, and that seemed to, you know, to answer it quickly. I think that would be one reason. Yeah, we've got to get as many in here as possible, right?
Would you say that at this point, then, creationists have come up with this proof?
Who wants to take a stab at that one? You want to read it again?
Okay, well, kind of in response to this, would you say that creationists have then come up with the proof at this point? No, proof that they didn't have back in the first time.
You got the big question, did you? That I wasn't supposed to answer just before we...
Oh, okay.
Very good. No, I do. So who wants to... You know, this is an open forum. I mean, I'm a historian, not a molecular biologist or something. And I'm all right on ideas, but if you get into the proof or something else, yeah.
The question that comes to my mind is what place does the empirical looking at that come in, and where does the our Christian background, our religious background come in?
Yeah.
And how do we separate the two and look at, because you know it's hard to
I agree.
Integrate both.
One helpful way for me, and if this doesn't help for you, you know, tell me. One helpful way for me is to approach this as pointing out the difference between what you could call cumulative knowledge and non-cumulative knowledge. Cumulative knowledge is simply that on which we can build, especially in the natural sciences, which everybody can agree on. I think all chemists agree on a periodic table. And they didn't really, we didn't have quote chemistry until, what was his name, the French name, Lavoisier, found and defined what an element was. Otherwise, up until 1792, if I remember, they depended on Aristotle's classification that everything was either air, earth, fire, or water. You know, sounds like a rock group. Lavoisier came up with 32 elements, and actually 22 of these are still elements. And they've been able to build, what, they have 106 elements, some chemistry, maybe 106 elements, okay. And that is cumulative knowledge. We've added to it, and as everybody agrees, remember that we tried to clean it up there in the wall and everything else, but that's cumulative knowledge. And biology, you know, and physics, you know, all the different fields have built that kind of cumulative knowledge. Non-cumulative knowledge is that which deals with, you know, what you call the spirit, the soul, you know, of the eternal, the transcendent, the mysterious, and everything else. We don't know, we don't quote, know anymore than those who were searching for God or whatever it was at that time. We aren't any quote wiser in our on our understanding of the meaning of the universe than those who speculated you know way back when. And that's where I would like to make that distinction. Yeah.
Well then I would tend to agree with the empiricist stuff there on the point that because this is the best hypothesis that this has come up with so far, and I think it's a mistake maybe that, you know, it is assumed that evolutionist viewpoint is anti accepting any other hypothesis which may come up which has better evidence.
Okay.
Horses that'll run faster, but they've never been able to make a horse into a cow. those examples, though, are not concrete, I don't believe.
Well,
they're still theory. They're just trying to close the gap all the time, to find this missing link, you know, that will just really tie it together. But I've never seen that sort of agenda.
Well, okay, the story that I'm talking about is just, it's wonderfully given from biology a lot. And that's about the fact that in England there are these white moths. I don't know if you're familiar with this story. But there were these white moths that were native to the area. And every once in a while there would be a mutation that would cause the stone moth to be, but it would always be killed because it would be picked off by birds. And so they figured for white. Well, then when England industrialized, there was a lot of soot and stuff in the air, the cheese and everything, everything became dust. And all of a sudden, you know, the dust moths were the ones that were camouflaged, and the white ones were the ones that were picked off by birds. And lo and behold, the dust moths became the majority. And eventually, you know, there weren't virtually any white moths at all.
But there are still moths.
There's still moths,
oh,
yeah.
There's still moths, okay. That's, you know, but...
I see what you're saying.
The kind of big evolutionary change you're talking about is something that we're not going to notice for generations. I mean, when biologists talk about evolution, they're talking about a billion years. So they're talking about a long, long time that we're not going to ever see.
Okay. There's more over here. I'm just going to say that. I have a little trouble in... accepting the fact that studying evolution is science and studying creation is not a science. To me, I would define science as a systematic way of thinking about a specific subject matter. And any subject matter or any method that you use is based on some kind of an absolute presupposition that it ends itself. And
what
even, evolutionists that get supported made a statement that the creationists accept natural facts and this is going to change some. And I think deep down, even in the scientist, quote unquote, the evolutionist, he has accepted some basic supposition by which he bases his investigation and his question and his proof. And it really isn't a legitimate differentiation of scientists and non scientists between an evolutionist and a creationist. I don't see that there's a basic differentiation between an evolutionist and a creationist by using the concept of science.
But by definition,
as opposed to presuppositions in a systematic way of thinking about what we're doing.
By definition, a scientist is one who begins with no preconception and then begins to study. With creationism, you have a preconception immediately.
I would argue this, Jim, one of the ways that a scientist measures is by using distance or time or something like this. Time in itself requires an absolute presupposition that you accept it in yourself.
True.
You don't need it. So I don't think you can get to a point where you can say that the scientist has no knowledge and no basis from which to begin his investigation.
Those are all working preconceptions. I don't know how the acceptance of God is a working preconception in the same way.
But what the evolutionists say is that if the creationists have a viewpoint that it will dampen, if not stop, you know, scientific inquiry, because in a sense the answers are already in, and that one should follow, you know, investigation wherever it leads with it. Because just as one example, the whole field of social biology it is kind of frightening in its implications, but the implication is that we are all programmed in our genes and chromosomes. And that there isn't a whole lot, once we sort of mature physically after puberty, that we can do about the way our lives turn. And this is kind of a frightening...
I didn't hear a predestination on anybody fighting.
No, not the least. You've listened to this new thing, social biology, that's coming on, that we're working on.
I think that maybe part of the problem is that we tend to use the word fact, synonymously with science, and assume that anything outside of science is therefore not fact.
I had a class last semester, which is really, you know, it was on philosophy of religion, and it talked about looking at the world empirically and trying from what we observe in the world to just prove that God exists. And the problem I have, I guess, it is integrating, you know, like you said, the two areas of, you know, thinking empirically millennia, I can see why the proofs that were tried just to God are impossible, because we can't prove God as, you know, he's, and yet you have to, I don't know.
Yep, you mean,
I'm open for any.
Yeah, over here, you had your hand up, and then I want
to.
Oh, Emily, you want to speak to this one? Well, be that there isn't, but I always, I mean, the way I like to look at Genesis 1 and 2 is that they are sort of Hebrew Sabbath school lessons, in which young people are told that God, you know, created the universe, and the details are not that important with it. But that's just my own viewpoint. Maybe we'd get more fun. Yeah, you want to try another question?
The evolutionists look upon the ongoing creation of things like that can't.
Mm-hmm.
Once the creationists look at that, as Lutherans, we have a view that God is doing an ongoing creation.
Yeah.
But what is their position?
Yeah, excuse me.
Well, I would say that the difference would be that the creationists believe directed, that God is directing it, that what's happening is in the
chaos. But I have a feeling that he said that the creationists see that the creation is fixed.
Well, no, whatever is out there did not take place by any kind of norm, what we would call, what the evolution would call natural mutation or change, but that God had programmed, so to speak, all the changes ahead of time, and that what is happening with the mutation is already predetermined ahead of time, headed towards, you know, the final consummation. Up there, you give a balcony sometimes.
This is a little bit off the subject, but it's all on the same page. If with our separation of church and state, and if the court say we have to keep biblical creationism.
But they didn't say that. They just said that you have to qualify the absoluteness of evolution.
Well, but the idea behind these guys is to keep the form. How can we get around that other forms?
Now, the argument there, you see, is that there is no such thing as neutrality. That if you say if you want to come back at me on this one, I'm fine. That if you say there is no, you come value-free to studying the cosmos and life in it, you are actually presenting a form of, quote, religion by doing this, that there is no God, that there is no ultimate explanation, there is no transcendent reference at all. And therefore, the creationists argue that evolutionism is as much a, quote, religion as creationism is. And that, therefore, you should have the option, the creationists should have the option of having their interpretation and their kind of religion presented in the school. Yeah.
Must we see creation and evolution as mutually exclusive? It seemed that way in the presentation. Yeah.
Emily doesn't want to see them as mutually exclusive.
And that's how I would hope to see it too. And I guess I didn't hear that.
But Charles Darwin certainly did, I think. He saw them as mutually exclusive and as proving that there really was God.
I would disagree.
From what I understand and my reading, that's the way he saw it.
Okay. And in the balcony, you know. Remember, what was that old TV? I mean, the radio quiz show? Somebody's got a question in the balcony, right? Doctor in the house, right?
There are more strands, or is there a spectrum, which one can fall if they are already established with various people we didn't know, into which you can even have a category of theistic evolution.
Yeah.
And Darwin would fall in that category. On the other side, to say that the creationists are firm and fixed, yet have God account for change, would be closer to deism. That is, having the whole thing programmed from the start, more predestined, and go that way. And that way they make some kind of allowance for evolutionary change. But in between you have a gradation. And Darwin is not so fixed as to say that religion is wrong. Rather, he saw God as having a kind of deistic role in evolution from the other side.
What? You brought a pregnant pause to the growth.
proved whether or not mutations happen randomly or by God's program and design. I mean, that's totally out of the realm of really science, certainly, and maybe even out of the realm of religion.
Well, I don't accept the fact that mutations, just because there are very close similarities in the white moth and the brown moth situation, I don't necessarily believe that that was mutation. I mean, this was assumed, I believe, and this hasn't really been proven. So with human beings or with moths, one species may have died out. We know the species that died out, carrier pigeon, a number of other things, possibly white moth, that BK in England. That doesn't necessarily prove the mutation.
You're not sure that
it's a
mutation?
No, I think, now I know that you can breed faster racehorses and cows that give more milk and so forth, but you're not, I haven't seen it proved that that cow is going to evolve into a giraffe or something.
No.
Yeah. Okay, it won't, yeah.
It won't, but that's not what the evolutionists are saying, though. No. But
many of our seen it proved that there is a God. Mm-hmm.
Okay, over here, we've been waiting from human very close.
Oh, can I just say Darwin supposedly was assisting all the birds, all the sisters, all the time.
Well, some are saying here that there's no necessary conflict, and they're trying to find a reconciliation between the two.
Life is trying to talk about religion, and it's hard to talk about, like you said, non-cumulative knowledge in cumulative terms,
yeah.
Or vice versa. And so, you know, it's like you have two different languages to talk about these different things. And
yeah.
I wanted to ask about the comment you made to him about a cow mutating to a giraffe. He said, that's not what they're talking about. But way back in the beginning, they're talking about sea life changing to dry land life, one cell life changing to multi-cell life.
I should have qualified in saying that, you know, in a time frame, as you mentioned, a million or a billion years or something like this. But I would object to just using cow and giraffe.
That was radical. Well, do you object to ape and man?
Who's going to bail me out on that one?
That there is that gradient there. You know, you're not talking maybe about a real radical change. I mean, for all of the groups and animals and stuff that they have, there are kind of intermediates.
That's what I question. I mean, that's what they claim, but I don't believe it.
Well, I don't have any here to show you, and I can't name them.
Just because you can find, you know, like white moths and brown moths and purple moths, that doesn't necessarily mean that the white moth went from the brown moth to the purple.
Okay, up to the balcony.
Something that I want to address is your question there. I also experienced that type of conflict, I think I've resolved it the way. I have a brother-in-law who is a zoologist here, and we have this fun time talking about things because he comes with a mindset that science is absolute fact. But then again, he can't accept vague things at all. And it seems like I'm a sociology major, and every class that I end up with, there's no discussion answer for anything. But the thing that I think we have to understand is when we're talking about cumulative knowledge, it isn't ultimate knowledge, and we have to accept that. And we also have to accept, those of us who like things that are vague have to accept what's observed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back there for...
I think part of the problem is people are trying to compare apples and oranges in the sense that science is a knowledge of something that's been studied or learned, and a lot of people that I hear talking about evolution and really standing up for it, the belief, that's a belief, and to compare knowledge and belief doesn't work for me. I think you can have both at the same time, like Emily's saying, and you know, why be so vehement about one or the other? To me, if indeed God did think of all these great things of evolution, that just makes them more...
Okay.
Then, you know, we're talking about maybe, you know, the creationists were right in saying that, you know, most scientists believe, because it is still a hypothesis, but it is still the scientific thinking, which is the evolutionary theory is through scientific thinking, through models, through, you know, and those things are that bound to change.
Bill will have a final word here, because it's time for petrol.
Well, the problem is, the kids come home from school, and they've learned in Sunday school that God is the creator. Their school teacher says, no, some big bang thing happened, and the whole thing process got started. Too many years ago, you can't even fathom it. And this is the problem. And the parents think that the school is destroying the faith of the children, which has happened. And I don't think there's ever going to be this side of the kingdom, that there will be a solution to the problem.
I've got the last one. I did a cartoon in the New Yorker. It shows two amphibians, and this comes from the Darwinian idea. Remember that originally life was in the ocean, and then they came ashore and started evolving. And there are two creatures coming out of the ocean, up on the beach, and one says to the other one, are you sure we really want to start all of this?